Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
In fact, let's talk about last night's doubleheader. Jazz Rockets, Game 5, followed by Clippers Warriors, Game 5. Houston and Golden State both came into last night with 3-1 leads. So it's just a matter of finishing off a pair of gentlemen sweeps and then moving on to the matchup that everybody cares about. The one matchup everybody wants to see. Houston handles their business. They beat Utah by 7, 193, and then it was up to Golden State. The Warriors were at home. And after that really bizarre record scratch in Game 2, they smashed the Clippers in Game 3. They did what they needed to do in Game 4, so everything was back on track. Everything was going to script until the game actually started. Because like everybody in LA who says they read the script, the Clippers did not read your script. And if they did, they only read the first few pages, and then they ignored the rest. LA, 129. Golden State, 121. And you know all the jokers are out there with their looks like Golden State still can't handle a 3-1 lead jokes. You know, hilarious stuff. Really brilliant. Except the problem for Golden State is actually threefold. Number one, they were looking ahead. That's not speculation. That's not conjecture. They were looking ahead. That's fact. Klay Thompson admitted as much. Klay said, quote, "Yep, started with me. I thought we'd come out and win tonight. Sometimes life doesn't go as planned," end quote. Not all of them were owning that. Some of them were saying, no, that's not the case. But Klay owned it. And it's a fact. They were. Number two, their defense was pretty crappy. That's fact also. That's not me. They own that. And they're pissed about it. Draymond Green, quote, "The terrible defensive night falls on me. If I bring the intensity from the start, everyone usually falls in line," end quote. All right, so two problems. They're looking ahead, and their defense is no good, at least last night. Draymond is pissed about the defensive intensity, and then Klay, well, Klay is pissed about pretty much everything.
"There ain't no building. Let's go do what we do. Like, build from this game. This game sucked. We lost. Let's go win Friday. Let's win big. Let's freaking win by 30. We're capable of. But it's basketball, so I'm excited for Friday."
All right, so if you had trouble making that out, if you're a Warriors fan, you got to be happy about that. What he said was, it sucked. Tonight sucked. Let's go out there and win by 30. Let's do what we do. So if you're a Warrior fan, as bad as last night was, you got to like to hear that. But there is a third problem here. The third problem is the LA Clippers. I've said it again, or I've said it before, I'll say it again. Give the Clippers some bleeping credit. I mean, for real.
Give them some credit. I mean, for real.
Last night is not just about what Golden State didn't do. It's about what the Clippers did do, which is play Clipper basketball. And Clipper basketball is about battling for everything. Man, they'll give you the hands. They don't back down, and they're not just happy to be there. Last thing you want to do is let these guys hang around and give them a reason to believe, especially when they already thought they were going to win the series coming in. Not dead, can't quit. Not dead, can't quit. And now Golden State has to get on another plane and deal with the Clippers in their joint, while Houston is at home getting their rest and getting ready for the Dubs. Allegedly. Just know that what happened last night is not a surprise, or at least it shouldn't be a surprise, because this is who both these teams are in 2019. Classic 2019 Warriors and Clippers. A classic Warriors game where they make things tougher than they have to be. A classic Clippers game where they make everything hard for you. I'm telling you, the Clippers are tough as hell. They're everything the Lakers aren't, as a team and as an organization. At this point, the Lakers aspire to be the Clippers. The Lakers are looking up at the Clippers. The Lakers want to be the Clippers. Again, the Clips are the better team. They're the better organization. When did you think you would ever say that? Not in this lifetime, but it's a fact. On and off the floor. On the floor, Pat Beverly was everywhere. Like, I don't care what the sport is. I don't care what the game is. I don't care what level it is. I don't care what the job is. I don't care about anything at all. I just want Pat Beverly on my side in anything and everything. Because Patrick Beverly approaches every single minute of every single game like his life depends on it. Patrick Beverley, 17 points. Patrick Beverley, 5 threes. Patrick Beverley, 14 boards. Let me repeat that. Patrick Beverley, 14 rebounds. The guy's listed at 6'1", 185. And in a must-win elimination game, the guy had 14 rebounds. I guess what I'm getting at is this. Pat Beverley is essentially the guy that I want to be, honestly. Patrick Beverley is essentially the dude we all want to be. This guy's on the deck. He's drawing an offensive foul. He's getting a technical foul on Draymond Green while only wearing one shoe. Late in the fourth, he took another charge on Klay Thompson. And he's a hype man for his teammates. A hype man for sweet Lou Williams.
Lou, one of the best players in the league, man. I think. I think you being modest though. I mean, he a killer, man. I don't guard the best of him. I see him every day in practice, man. I mean, he is a real killer, man. He goes up with, some of the best scorers in the NBA, and I think he should be up there with, some of the superstar players in this league, cuz he's doing it day in and day out. At 6'1 and a half, I believe. And
I agree. I could not agree more. Lou Williams should be up there with some of the superstar players in the league, and so should Patrick Beverley, because they're giving the two-time defending champs hell. And in terms of Lou Williams and his 33 off the bench, all that dude does is get buckets. All that dude does is get buckets. You can give him the ball and say, get us points, and he will. And there is no bigger bucket than this sequence. Kevin Durant gets in for a dunk to take the lead in the fourth and get that home crowd going ballistic.
By Green, slapped it over to Iguodala. Here's Durant to the rim.
Ballistic, Mav. Yeah, no problem.
We're going ballistic, Mav. Go
because then him. Sweet Lou did this.
From 50 to 47. Lou lighting left, firing right. Three plus one.
Clippers off the bounce. Durant on the late closeout hits him.
28 points, 10 assists for Lou Williams.
Three and a foul. And it's not just Beverley and Williams. There's also Montrezl Harrell and his 24 points and 5 rebounds in 27 minutes. This guy was a monster last night. I would say the Clippers are punching above their weight, but they're not. This is who they are, and this is what they do. They've got an identity, and the identity is they'll give you the hands for 48. And if you let down, if you let up, let down, and look past them, you're going to get knocked the hell out. And that's what happened in Golden State last night. And now they're in a brawl that they never expected but should have. Doc Rivers said it best in the locker room after the game.
We were just, who were we today? We were just us. Who were we today? Us. Let's go.
So they go into Golden State. They wreck it, and then they ate in and out afterwards. It's not even a figure of speech. It's a fact. They go into Golden State's house. They wreck it, and then they chase that with the in and out. Look, they're not just looking to make Golden State work. They're not just looking to stretch out the series. They're looking to win it. That team is not just happy being there. That team is not just happy being down 3-2 and looking to win one more game so they can tell everybody they forced the defending champs to 7. They want to win 2 more and advance. They're not looking to take part. They're looking to take over. And sleeping on these guys is one of the biggest mistakes you can make. Drop your hands, you'll get knocked the hell out. That's what happened to Golden State last night. Golden State already knew what happened when they blew that 31-point lead. Golden State already knew that Houston had advanced. Golden State knew they were home, and they knew what they had to do, and they still couldn't get it done. Part of that's on them, but a big part of that is on the LA Clippers. Man, give them some bleeping respect already. Daniel Jeremiah is my guest. DJ, good to have you on. How are you?
What's up, Jim? How's it going, bud?
Good, good. My man, you're in Nashville for the draft. It's only a few hours away. What has your morning and your day been like so far?
Well, I'll tell you what happened about maybe 15 minutes ago. It wasn't a paranoid feeling, but it was one of those, like, gosh, I'm forgetting something. Like, what have I not done? Is there some preparation that I'm not ready for? What is it? And I was like, oh, yeah, you got to eat. I better get a little snack. But it's been fun, man. Constant phone calls. Everybody's fishing. Not a lot of giving, a lot of fishing.
Listen, I know how frustrating it can be if you're running late or you're in a hurry to find yourself stuck at a railway crossing waiting for the train to go by. And if the signals are going and the train's not even there yet, you might even feel tempted to try to sneak across the tracks. Like, what could happen, right? Wrong. Don't do it. Ever. For any reason. Trains are going a lot faster than you expect them to be. They cannot stop. Even if the engineer hits the brakes right away, it could still take a train over 1 mile to stop. By that time, what used to be your car is simply a crushed hunk of metal. And what used to be you? Well, better that we not go there. The point is, you can't know how quickly the train is going to arrive. The train can't stop even if it does see you. The result is the worst thing ever. If the signals are on, the train is on its way. And you need to remember only one thing. To stop, because the trains cannot. We're talking to Daniel Jeremiah, man, get some grub. All right, so yesterday you tweeted, quote, what I've heard in the last 24 hours, Redskins moving up for Haskins, Redskins moving up for Jones, Giants moving up for Locke, Giants taking Jones at 17, Titans taking Locke, Bengals taking Haskins, Bengals not taking QB, Lions trade back and take QB. So, end quote, in terms of unpredictability, how does this year's draft compare to ones in recent memory?
Well, you can add to that, Raiders take Locke at 4, Raiders take Haskins. I mean, like, it's this morning, there's even more stuff floating around, flying around. So it's the most unpredictable draft that I can remember, man. It's going to be a lot of fun. Who knows? We could see these quarterbacks fly off the board, and maybe everybody's bluffing and they all slide down. But that's why it's going to be a fun night.
So you've been in draft rooms on the day of a draft, so you know. If you had to guess, how many teams at this point really have a good sense, a really good sense as to what they're going to do and how things are going to play out?
I think teams have a good sense and a good feel of what they want to happen and how they like guys, but there's more uncertainty in terms of who's going to be there. That's why you've seen so many teams making calls. Everybody, it seems, wants to get back. There aren't a whole lot of people looking to move up from what I've heard, but those phone calls continue on. So, you know, there's some players like Rashawn Gary, Jim. If he went 6 to the Giants, I wouldn't be shocked. If he were there with the Seahawks of the pick they just acquired at the bottom of the first round, I would not be surprised. Like, there's huge range for some of these guys.
Daniel Jeremiah joining us. I'm going to double back and follow you up on the Giants in 1 minute, but let me just start at the top. If we're talking about Arizona, there have been all sorts of rumors, different suggestions about what they'll do with that first pick. Ultimately, DJ, what do you think they will do and why?
Well, I'll go with the majority of the information guys that feel pretty good about this being Kyler Murray, and it's been that way for a while. So I know there's been a lot of chatter here at the end of the line that maybe it is Quinnen Williams, maybe it's Bosa. But for the majority of the process, since they hired Cliff Kingsbury and it began to creep out that this was going to be their guy, I'm going to stick with that it ends up being Kyler Murray. Now, and we've had this conversation before. You know, what would I do in that spot? I'll tell you what, I'd go draft Nick Bosa or even Quinnen Williams. I'd be fine with either guy, and I wouldn't punt on Josh Rosen after 1 year playing on a terrible football team.
Daniel Jeremiah joining us. All right, I can respect that. If, in fact, though, they do take Murray, what do they do with Rosen? Do they trade him either before the draft or during it?
They've said, I mean, they've wanted it out that they are willing to keep him. They're not going to give him away, and I think Pete Schrager even said they're not going to give him away for 60 cents on the dollar. So, to me, I look at it and say, I think they just want that out, because when they get that out, that gives them at least a little bit of leverage. I think it has to happen, you know, right when they pick him. That trade needs to go down, because in a game of musical chairs, those quarterback spots are going to fill up, and now you have no leverage.
Daniel Jeremiah, my guest. All right, so what if, for instance, Rosen were coming out this year? Where would he rank among the quarterbacks in this class? And then how might that influence the way teams make a decision when it comes to making a deal for him, possibly?
Well, this is where there's just a disconnect. I don't know exactly what I'm missing, because when I watch Josh in college, now let's try and wipe your memory of what you saw this year on that bad Cardinals team. But coming out, I had a higher grade on Josh Rosen than any of the quarterbacks in this year's draft class. So when you start hearing rumors that he could be had potentially for a third-round pick, he costs $2 million a year. That's it. The Cardinals already paid all the money. 3 years, $2 million. So that, to me, I don't get why there's not more of a market for him. And maybe that materializes late in the process.
Daniel Jeremiah joining us once again. All right, so with respect to what you said, the teams are looking to move down and not move up. Is it possible that if Murray does go number one, or I should say, could you see somebody trying to move up to take him at number one?
I don't think so at number one. I would say more likely if the Cardinals surprise us, and trust me, for a little draft shock and a little draft drama, I would love to see it. And they don't take him. You know, I think they would sit there and take one of those D linemen. I don't think they would get out of that pick. And then I think you start looking at San Francisco potentially as a spot, but three would be, that to me is the ticket, because the Jets have made it be known to everybody and their mother they want out of there. So if that's the case, I would think that would be the Kyler Murray spot, and the Redskins would be the team that would make the most sense.
All right. So if, in fact, Murray does not go number one, how far would he fall?
That's it. I mean, I would say four in Oakland is potential, and I don't have I don't know that they would do that there, but that would be a spot that would make a lot of sense. And I think you look at that trading up in front of Oakland to get to three. So three or four would make sense. Now, if he gets past four, now we're going to have some fun, because I don't know where that spot is. And then you start getting into something that's unique. This guy was offered $19 million by the Oakland A's. He continues to slide and slide and slide. All of a sudden, he's going to be giving up money instead of making money, and that's when that would be quite the scene.
Yeah, that gets really interesting then. Daniel Jeremiah joining us. All right, but flip back. If he does go number one and the Raiders are holding on to that fourth pick, what do you think they do? Are they looking for a quarterback there, or are they trying to get somebody to trade up to get a quarterback? What are the Raiders thinking coming into this?
Well, I think Haskins is in play. I know they like Dwayne Haskins. I think that's a possibility. But, Jim, this team had 13 sacks last year. I mean, this has got to be about improving that number and getting better up front. You're in a division with Pat Mahomes and Phillip Rivers. That's who you got to go after, and you have zero pass rush, none. So when you're sitting there at number four, you've got to get somebody that can pressure the quarterback, and to me, to not take one there would be a huge, huge missed opportunity.
We're talking to Daniel Jeremiah. Okay, you mentioned the Jets. They're in the third spot. Do they stay there and take a defensive player, or would they rather move down? Is that pretty much a accepted thing that they're going to move down?
Yeah, I mean, they've been so active in pursuing a trade down and finding out what's out there. They have no second-round pick, and there's some great players that will be there at number three. But I also look at it and say, you've got Sam Darnold, year two. Offensive line-wise, they could use some reinforcements. They're not going to take one at three. There's no value there. So you could trade down, get an offensive lineman to help you out a little bit, and then hopefully get a second-round pick, which they currently don't have.
We're talking to Daniel Jeremiah. DJ, I talked to Trent Dilfer, who obviously loves Haskins. I talked to Jordan Palmer, who obviously likes him a lot too. What kind of marks do you give Haskins?
Well, I think, look, he's a little bit of a dependent player. You know, you got to have the stuff in front of him to keep him clean. He's just not real sudden or explosive. I think when people, you know, hear they use the word mobility and they think, you know, I don't need him to roll out or run read option. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm just looking for some of that quick, sudden movement when you get some pressure. Can you slide? Can you pull? Can you get away? He doesn't really have that. So, to me, if you keep him clean, man, he throws a beautiful ball. He can make every throw. By all accounts, he's a great kid. He's smart. He's tough. You love those things. I just think you draft Dwayne Haskins, you're committing to really invest in the offensive line, which, look, that's a smart thing to do anyways.
Daniel Jeremiah getting ready for a big, big night in Nashville. Before I let you go, the Giants, are they finally going to take a quarterback, the quarterback of the future, DJ, or do they just keep kicking that can right down the road?
Yeah, you know, Jim, it's what you hear late in the process, and part of that is from Dave Gettleman's press conference. That's my guilty pleasure, dude, is watching those pre-draft press conferences. These guys say nothing except for Gettleman. He's like a straight shooter at that thing. Last year, he said, we're going to take a gold jacket player, the best player on the board, regardless of position. That clearly pointed to Barkley. They did that. This year, he said, we will not elevate a quarterback if he's not the highest rated player. So that, to me, looks pass rusher at six, and cross your fingers and toes the quarterback you want there at 17.
I was going to say, DJ, I thought you might go there with that. So if they do need a quarterback, how big of a risk would that be to pass on a quarterback at six and try to get their guy at 17?
Well, it's a statement on how they feel about Eli, that they're very comfortable with him, not just for a year, maybe a couple more years of him being their guy, because you don't take that risk if you feel the pressure to get that done right now to find that next guy. To me, they don't take one at six. If I'm Eli Manning, you know, I'm saying, okay, I've got a couple more years here.
All right, so before I let you go, what do you think the Patriots will do in this year's draft?
You know, it'll be interesting. We'll see what happens with these Iowa tight ends. If one of them were to slide a little bit, I could see them be aggressive and go up there and try and get one of those guys. But trying to predict what Belichick's going to do is something I stopped doing a long time ago.
And is there a name or two that's off the radar at the moment that you think might go earlier than people expect?
Yeah, you know, keep an eye on Brian Burns from Florida State.
Love him.
I have him kind of as a player more in the 20s, but his name, you know, when you're talking to these teams and they go, you know, where would I have to go to get Burns? And that's teams picking high, talking about trading back, and that's teams picking low, talking about trading up. His name has come up a lot.
Glad to hear that. I love the guy. You can follow Daniel Jeremiah on Twitter at Move the Sticks. He is host of the Move the Sticks podcast. Good friend of the program. And remember, you can see Daniel on NFL Network's live coverage of the 2019 NFL Draft from Nashville tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern. DJ, I know you've got a really busy day. Thanks so much for making time for us, as always. Have a great night.
You're my guy, Jim. Thanks, bud.
Now, you can earn O Rewards points online and at your local O'Reilly Auto Parts store. Earn points any way you shop at O'Reilly Auto Parts. You'll get $5 back for every 150 points you earn. Visit orewards.com and become an O'Reilly O Rewards member today. The draft is finally here. After months of buildup, the draft is finally here. Months of talking to draft prospects on this show. Months of people looking and seemingly finding every single flaw. Months of hearing about freaks, fluid hips, smooth breaks. Months of discussing whether drafting for need or best available is the way to go. Months of talking about tangibles, intangibles, measurables. Months of good motors, tight ankles, bad pad height, good hand movement, great locker room guys. And then after all that,
borderline erotic.
It's all borderline erotic.
Borderline erotic.
And after all that, I'm not sure anybody really knows what to expect tonight. Typically, the first pick in the draft is pretty obvious. Sometimes it's so obvious that the team has already announced it and signed the guy even before the draft. But not this year. This year, it feels like anything could happen with that first pick. And then, with everything that comes after it. For instance, the Cardinals, they've already made a power move, taking that enormous swing by hiring Cliff Kingsbury. So do you double down on that big swing and take Kyler Murray? Or do you say that you've already got your franchise quarterback in Josh Rosen? Ask the big head. Flight deck, James Kelly. He would tell you they already have their franchise quarterback in Josh Rosen. Daniel Jeremiah said as much. So do you do that? Do you keep Rosen and then do you look at defense with that first pick? Or do you trade the first pick and address multiple issues on the roster? Is there any way that the Cards, hours away from submitting that pick, really don't know what they're going to do yet? Well, here was Mike Silver's tweet earlier this morning. Silver tweeted, quote, "According to several sources familiar with the Cardinals' plans, the team ran an inclusive redraft process that encouraged blunt evaluations from coaches and scouts and emerged with a mindset that three players, Nick Bosa, Quinnen Williams, Kyler Murray, stood above the rest. That puts multiple scenarios in play as the start of the draft nears. And I'm told by Cardinal sources that people could be surprised by the outcome." End quote. Obviously, is that real? Is it real or is that smoke? Is that an attempt to generate more trade interest? So where does Kyler Murray go? How about Dwayne Haskins? What about all the monsters on the defensive line? What do the 49ers do at number two? How about the Raiders at four? How about the Raiders at 24? How about the Raiders at 37? Actually, what are the Raiders doing anywhere at any time? And do their scouts know about it? Do their scouts have any say in it? And what about the Giants? Everybody thinks the Giants need a quarterback. Well, everybody not named the Giants. Do they think they need a quarterback? Or are they back to thinking that they're somehow a Super Bowl team because they traded their best receiver ever and that Eli Manning is going to play forever? Oh, and then there's that noise about the Redskins wanting to rush to the top of the draft for a quarterback. Grant Paulson tweeted yesterday, quote, "Just talked to a Redskins source who told me Dan Snyder has, quote, taken over the first round of the draft," end quote. The last time that happened, The Redskins traded two future number ones and a number two to move up for Robert Griffin. Oh, hell yes. Hell yes. I am totally here for a team mortgaging its future to get a quarterback, especially if that team is the Redskins, because they have such an awesome history of evaluating quarterbacks. That'd be the best. I so badly want that to be true. If Dan Snyder really has, quote, taken over the first round of the draft, that might be the best thing ever. Just barreling past the Raiders for the weirdest buildup to the draft. I can't trust anybody or anything at this point, but I trust that if Dan Snyder is taking over the first round of the draft, it is going to go horribly. How little do I trust anybody right now? Vikings GM Rick Spielman had this to say at his pre-draft press conference.
My wife, I'll leave that at home. She said, if I draft another corner, though, don't come home. She goes, you can just stay at the office.
So Rick Spielman's wife said, if you're going to draft another corner, man, don't come home. Which either means that he's not going to take a corner at 18, or his wife is in on the smoke screens. Or his wife is in on the smoke screens. Hey, listen, I'm not sure I can trust anybody or anything at this point. Here is the only thing that I do know. The draft is going to start at 8 p.m. in Nashville. And one more lock. Roger Goodell will get booed the moment he steps on stage. After that, it's wide ass open. It's a crapshoot. There will be surprising picks. There will be extremely awkward hugs. Awkward. And somehow everybody will say that they got exactly the guy they wanted. Trust your evaluations, work your boards, draft for need, take the best available, or whatever you want. Good night and good luck. Damian Lillard is our guest. Damian, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
I'm good, man. How you doing?
Good, good. So, Damian, have you seen the shot since the game? And if you have, what do you think when you watch it?
Yeah, I have seen it. It was just crazy because during the game I felt like it was going to come down to something like that. Just like the one possession, I knew we was going to have to dig deeper to try to figure out a way to win the game. You know, I knew it was going to be that type of thing. And to see it end that way after already having an experience like that, after having an experience like that once before, it was just like, it was deja vu. You know, it was just a crazy feeling to be back in that same exact position again.
Damian Lillard, my guest. You know, I'm not sure what's more amazing, the shot, the wave, or the look into the camera when you were being mobbed, and then the post-game interview on the court. I mean, you really weren't freaking out at all. It was like scoring 50 and sending OKC packing on the final shot of the game. It was no big deal whatsoever. How were you so calm in that moment?
I mean, it was a big deal. It was a big deal. I don't want to play it off like I was too cool for that moment, because it was a big moment. You know, obviously, after our past two postseasons, all the back and forth between the two teams in the entire series, and, you know, then for it to happen in that fashion, you know. So I was excited about it, but I think even in my highest moments, I'm pretty composed. You know, I'm never too outside of myself. And it was just a great feeling, man, you know, to be able to have 50 in the closeout game, hit the game winner, mobbed by the team, and then the camera was just happened to be right there, and I just kind of looked up like, oh, camera right here. So, I mean, it was a great feeling. I was excited. I don't want to play it off like I wasn't excited, but I mean, that's just more of a typical look for me to look like I'm not excited, but I usually am on the inside.
Damian Lillard joining us. You know, in terms of that, like, obviously, it was a huge moment, and I know you just acknowledge it. You and I have talked in the past about your approach to the game, so there's no doubting your passion and your desire to win, but at the same time, you may not always show that on the outside. How much of that is about being the unemotional, reserved, calm, detached warrior, quote-unquote, in the middle of that chaos?
I think that stuff is important. That stuff is important, just because to have that type of mentality and that type of approach, you got to train yourself for that, not just physically but mentally. And I think when you truly do those things, and it's an inner confidence. It's something that you're just sure of in your mind and in your heart. So, you know, when it happens on the inside, you're like, yeah, I'll prepare for this. You know, it's almost like you're talking to your way instead of being excited because you're being validated by everybody on the outside. You know what I mean? It's just everybody's witnessing it. And, you know, typically you will be so excited and that people are watching you do something so crazy. But for me, a lot of times I know what went into it. So on the inside, I'm like, yes, like I got the result that I basically invested in, you know, to get. And that's the feeling that I like the most, you know, is knowing that I did the stuff to put myself in that position and then it actually coming to life and having it. So that's more what it is. It's not that I'm not excited, because I am. It's just that on the inside, it's a different thing, you know.
Damian Lillard joins us. We're talking about the Blazers advancing. You know, from the outside, it seemed like Russell Westbrook thought that he was in a personal battle with you. Were you in a personal battle with him?
No, I wasn't. I think it was a personal battle, just from the standpoint of, look, we both the leaders of our team. We both all-star point guards. We both super competitive. And we knew that, you know, who each team was going to go as we went. You know, his team is going to go as he goes, and my team is going to go as I go. And whoever can outplay the others is going to have the greater chance to advance. So I think it was personal in that way. But I think the media and, you know, people outside of the actual situation have made it into more of a me versus him thing than it actually is. Obviously, we're going to battle it out. We both got strong personalities and a lot of pride and competitive. So, I mean, you're going to get what you got, but it's actually no issue there, you know? I think I just didn't really like how they tried to make it seem like there was a real issue between us, and me and Russ is cool, you know? Me and Russ, off the court, we actually are cool. And it's just that this is our career, and both of our season was on the line. A lot was on the line, and we had to battle it out, and, you know, that was it.
Damian Lillard joins us. So, Damian, my guy Chris Haynes, I thought had a great piece for Yahoo. And one of the things that he said in it was, quote, he had you quoted as saying, I'm not out here to prove to these dudes that I'm the hardest mother bleeper in the league because they cussed at me on the court, but they know where I'm from. They know what I'm about. This is Oakland, but I don't take my bleep personal. My goal is just to get the win, end quote. So my question is, how do you get that balance between showing where you're from and what you're about, but not taking that bleep personally?
I think you don't take it personal, because on the court, people say a lot of things. Just, you know, when you're passionate about it and emotional about the game, sometimes you just say things out of, you know, in that state of mind that you don't really mean. And it's competitive. Some people say stuff just to get in your head or just to irritate you or frustrate you. So I never take what's being said personal on the court. You know, like I said, guys say things out of emotion, say things in the moment, stuff like that. But I don't think I've ever given people the vibe of somebody that's going, you know, that's going to front and that's going to start nothing and, you know, try to play tough and all that stuff. But, you know, we know, like, players around the league, we know about each other. You know people's backgrounds and where they're from and stuff like that. And I don't think being from Oakland just makes me the hardest person in the world. But I come from a place where you have to be tough. You have to be fearless, and you get challenged and tested, you know, just growing up where I grew up. So there's no fear there. There's no worry. When I'm playing basketball, I'm focused on basketball and winning the game. I'm not focused on trying to prove how tough or ain't nobody going to say this to me or that to me. You know, that's not my focus. So that was kind of what I meant. Like, you know, anybody on the court, they just say what they want. And if it ever came a time where like my manhood was challenged or something like that, then, you know, they would have to prove it to me. But I don't think it's ever come to that. You know, I don't want it to sound that way. I'm just saying I'm just not going. That's not my focus on what somebody is saying to me or feeling disrespected by what they're saying, because I know how people get during games, and, you know, that's it.
Damian Lillard is joining us once again. You know, Haynes also had this story about how you had some people at your house Monday night to watch the Houston-Utah game. And at one point you said, quote, I'm getting rid of these mother bleepers tomorrow. Also, another great quote, I thought.
Yeah.
What did you feel and know that made you say that in that moment?
I mean, I was just watching a game. Houston had a chance to sweep, you know, and I knew it was going to be hard for them because they were on the road trying to close out the series. In Utah, they play really well at home, great crowd. And they just had to, like, I knew anytime you're in an elimination game, you got to dig a little bit deeper, you know, because the team is going to go out fighting. You know, they want their season to continue. They leave it all out there for that game, so that's usually the hardest one. And it just made something click in my mind where I was like, tomorrow's going to be one of those games where I'm going to have to really, you know, put my will out there and try to will the team, and I'm going to have to really dig deep. You know, our group is going to have to really dig deep and go through something. You know, it's going to be a tough battle. And if we answer that call and we're willing to dig deep and do whatever it takes, we're going to come out on top in the end. And I think that actually came. You know, it came where we were down 15 in the fourth. And we just kept fighting. You know, that was the adversity that night that we had to go through to get it done, and we fought through it. And we get to the end of the game, and boom, you know, it was our moment. And it was something there that we had to fight through. So I was just like, this is supposed to be the end of the series. You know, 3-1, we could finish it at home. We can get some rest based on what the other series we'll be playing if we win is. We got to get this done. So at that moment, I kind of just made up my mind, like, this is what needs to happen.
We're talking to Damian Lillard, locked in. You know, you mentioned exerting your will. You talk about going through stuff. If you look at the big picture, if we go back a year, the season obviously did not end the way that anybody would have liked. And as a team and an organization, right, there's not only soul searching, but you could have fallen apart, but that didn't happen. And you've gotten a lot of credit for helping keep that whole thing together. As a leader, how did you go about leading in the aftermath of the last year?
I mean, it wasn't just me. You know, I think it takes a group to keep a group together, because there's always people that can be like, yeah, that sounds cool, but I ain't buying it, you know? So I think our team, you know, our entire group has done a great job, even our coaches and our training staff and the guys in the video room. Everybody's kind of just kept their head down and just kept working. But I think for me, it was just about, okay, you know, if they want to say all this stuff about us, when I do something great, you know, when I hit a game winner, like last game, they're giving me all this credit. You know, everybody wants to sing praises and all that stuff. And, you know, I accept that part of it. So once we got swept and everybody had bad stuff to say about us, I just said, I'm going to accept responsibility and I'm going to take as much blame as I can. You know, like every opportunity I get, I'm going to put it on myself. So my teammates don't have to, you know, I want to take them off the hook so they know that I'm willing to take the blame. I'm willing to bite the bullet or whatever. And then when I do that now, whatever I do going forward, you know, they'll respect it. And they'll be more willing to follow suit and trust and believe in that going forward. And for me, I said, all right, I'm accepted. I'm going to embrace what happened and the challenge and all that stuff. And going forward, I'm going to work harder. I'm going to be better. I'm going to be sharper. And I just felt like when you go through stuff like that, and we got good people in our team, we got a good culture, we got a good staff, we do things the right way consistently. And when you go through something like that, that means it was just your turn to experience that. And if you work through it and do what you're supposed to do when stuff like that hits, I feel like it's a reward for you at the end. And I think right now we just starting to see the beginning of what our reward for continuing to trust what we've done and staying together and continuing to work.
All right, so because of all that, you go through that. It's part of the process. It was your turn to go through that. You're better for it.
Exactly.
Do you feel like you personally, Damian, make it about yourself for 1 minute before you go, do you feel like you've reached a new level of mastery in your game?
I do. You know, I think I'm always trying to find ways to, like, how can I improve? You know, looking in the mirror and just trying to really look at things that I say, okay, you may not want to admit it to yourself or whatever, but you could do this better. You could do that better. You know, that's been my route to improving over my career. And, you know, now you reached a level where last year I made my third All-Star game. And now I'm saying, what can I do? And last summer I decided, you know, okay, the guy that I trained with, Phil Beckner, I'm just going to hire him permanently to, you know, where I can use him during the season, year round. I can just, you know, stay sharp. Don't have as many ups and downs in the season to where I'm just staying sharp. So, I mean, I think that was the biggest thing I did to keep myself moving up, you know, to keep getting better and going to the next level. And me and him, we working together during the week, during the regular season. He'll come to Portland for 2 weeks and we working out. And then me and our strength coach, Ben Kenyon, our routine, everything has been consistent, and we've done it on a different schedule than I've done it any other year in my career. So I think that's really propelled me to, like, a new level, just because of the details, the small stuff that I'm working on, the time that I'm putting on. It's not always a super hard workout, but it's really detailed and sharp. And then the body maintenance stuff, staying healthy, staying strong, staying explosive, staying fresh, staying rested, active recovery, all those types of things. I've done those things at a much different level this season consistently, and I think it's really showing in my game.
So finally then, Damon, hearing all that, and you've had a couple of walk-off playoff series winning shots, when you lay your process out like that, when you talk about the work you've done, the fact that you have this presence in key moments, how much of that is something you're born with, and how much of that is something you train for?
I think a lot of it is training for it, because I can't speak for everybody, but my confidence in the shots I take and the stuff that I do on the court comes from me knowing that I put the time in and me being comfortable in it because I've done it over and over and over. I think in the other part is just my upbringing. You know, I grew up in a family and around like a bunch of cousins and in a neighborhood around a bunch of people where you had to be able to hold your own, and you had to be in a group of kids where you're getting clowned on, and you're at the park where you got to be able to play basketball, football, and baseball. You got to be able to defend yourself and all that stuff. So I think it just develops toughness and confidence. Just good preparation, you know, almost like that survival of the fittest type of thing where, you know, if you can survive in that type of environment I grew up in, you need to be able to survive anywhere. You should be comfortable and confident anywhere. And that's how I feel about stuff I do on the court. Like, when I get in a situation, I feel confident in it. And then you add that with the time and the reps that I put in and the confidence you get from that and the comfort you get from that, you know, I think that's the result that you get. You just, those situations, you're just able to rise up to it because you're not afraid to fail. You're not afraid to, I guess, be ridiculed and talked about if you fail. And if you handle it right, it's kind of what you expected. Or if you're successful in that situation, it's what you expected. So I don't think nobody's born with it. I think it's developed.
Damian Lillard, my guest. My man, you and I have had some really, really amazing conversations over the years. But I'm going to say right now, never one quite like that. I appreciate you. I really appreciate you making yourself accessible today, Damian. That was an amazing game to watch. And I know you've got some unfinished business, but really good to get caught up. And thanks for making time for us. I appreciate you.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
Hey, now, if I had to sum up this show in one single word, it would probably be performance. Whether it's an important meeting or a business trip or you're fighting that afternoon crash, sometimes you need a boost and you want to perform too, but you want an alternative to coffee or sugary energy drinks. I get that. In fact, I've discovered something that's going to help you take your game to the next level. It is called Dawn to Dusk. I love this product, Dawn to Dusk, and it's by Brickhouse Nutrition. Dawn to Dusk was designed to be a healthier, more effective alternative to typical energy supplements. With as little caffeine as only one cup of coffee, Dawn to Dusk can provide up to 10 hours of clean energy. It heightens focus. It improves your mood, too. And unlike coffee, unlike energy drinks, there are no jitters or crash. Just clean energy and focus. No calories, no sugar. Go to BrickHouseRome.com and get 15% off your first order with the offer code ROME. 100% satisfaction guaranteed, so you've got nothing to lose. You have everything to gain, especially with a product this great. BrickHouseRome.com. That's BrickHouseRome.com. Derrick Henry's my guest. Derrick, it's great to have you on. How are you?
How you doing?
Good, man. Good. Great to have you. So the NFL draft starts tonight. Derrick, let me start right there in Nashville. Since you were drafted, you've got a pretty good idea of what that whole thing's about. But for those who do not know about Nashville as a city and a place to be, how would you describe Nashville? What's that town all about?
A very nice town. You know, I'm from the South, so I really like it. You know, you got good food, good music, you know, it's a great city. I'm sure everybody who's down here for the job is really enjoying it, you know, and it's a very nice city, you know, to visit. You know, they have like a lot of bachelor parties here. I think like number one in the U.S. for people to come visit. So, you know, it's a great city to come to. You like music, food, and fun.
Smashville, it's a great place. Derrick Henry joining us. So, as I mentioned off the top, you were drafted 3 years ago. As you look back, what do you remember about the entire draft experience? And then, what was it like when you finally heard your name called?
I was very anxious and nervous. You know, I was with my family. And friends and everybody who supported me, like, my name to be called, and, you know, it was just so surreal that they had finally came. I just couldn't wait. And I got my name called. I was very excited, you know, and one of the best days of my life.
Derrick Henry joining us. Now, you had a great, great college career, as I mentioned. How different are you as a running back now than when you were first drafted? Like, what do you know now that you didn't know then?
I think it's just, like, learning how to be a pro. You know, and I think as years went on with my experience, you know, I got better and better at doing that. You know, and you know, the pros, you just have to be consistent and play at a high level each and every year. And all the great ones did that. The ones you hear about to play my position and play other positions. And that's the main thing, is just focus on being a consistent player and playing consistent, you know, and playing at a high level. If you're going to be a superstar in this league.
Now, back in December, you had that 238-yard, four-touchdown game against Jacksonville, and then you had 170-yard, two-touchdown performance the following week. When you look back, Derrick, on last season, and in particular, how you and the team played in the month of December, what kind of thoughts do you have?
You know, we just had great chemistry. You know, we were carrying that momentum each week, you know, and playing at a high level. And that's what's expected, and that's what we should expect, you know, as a team, you know, just continue to keep doing that. And, you know, we added some great additions, you know, to the team this year and building that chemistry, working hard this off season, you know, and just ready to get started, you know, to put everything around us as a team.
You know, you're looking ahead, but as I go back to that month, that was such a huge month. The team went 4-1. You ran for 625 yards and 8 touchdowns. It was so good that the GM, John Robinson, said, quote, he proved that he could step in there and carry the load, and we'll try to put that right back on him, end quote. So what's your reaction when you hear that the organization knows you can carry that load and they want to put that on your back?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
You know it. Derrick Henry joining us. You know, you look at last season, maybe it didn't start the way you wanted it to, but then you got it rolling. But during the bye week last year, I know you reached out to Eddie George. What did the two of you talk about, and what was your takeaway from that conversation?
Yeah, just talking about my game and how I was playing. You know, I wasn't playing at a high level. I wasn't running like I was supposed to. He was telling me, you know, I'm a big guy. I use that at my advantage. You know, deliver goals, run physical, finish run. You know, be a consistent player. You know, those things. You know, the things that he did, you know, when he played at a high level, you know, just do those things, you know what I'm saying? Because I wasn't really doing that, you know, just evaluate myself and my game and how I was playing. And, you know, I'm glad he took the time to have a conversation with me, you know, to help me out, you know, when I needed it.
I mean, Derrick, so in terms of that, like, you're a good dude, but the one thing that keeps coming up is that you run hard and you run angry. Is it something that you consciously dial up when you step on the field? Or does that attitude just kind of show up and just happen?
Yeah, it's something that I always want to do, just run angry, run physical. You know, so I'm a big guy, so I kind of, you kind of have to. You have to have that physical presence, especially playing my position, you know, being a running back in the NFL, because you're always going to get hit. So you got to make sure you're being physical and delivering the blows.
Derrick Henry joining us. Now, you had that monster game against Jacksonville, and you were wearing cleats designed by the Special Olympics athletes. And after that game, they were auctioned off to raise money for Special Olympics Tennessee. The winning bid came from somebody named TitansFan22. For those who aren't tracking, that was you. What did it mean to be able to keep the cleats and to support the Special Olympics at the same time?
Oh, yeah, it's very special because I did Special Olympics, you know, in high school year after year. And I definitely wanted to, you know, do some cleats this time that I really had a passion for, 16 could relate to, because I did it back in high school, and I got time to spend time with the kids and let them put their arms out on the cleat. So it was a very cool moment, you know, to be able to do that, you know, and spend time with those kids and, you know, to see their design on TV, and then me have that game. So it was very cool and a very special moment.
That is cool. Good for you. Now, Alabama's got a couple of really unique running backs in this year's draft. Yeah. Damian Harris talks about the fact that he used to watch everything you did in games, after games, in the weight room, and that he really appreciates how you showed him the way. He calls you a role model. He said that you set the standard. What's it mean to hear that from him, and then how proud are you of him?
Very proud of Damian. You know, he did do those things. He always asked for advice. He always take me, you know, if he needed advice. You know, I had a good relationship when he was there, you know, as a freshman, you know, and he carried that on. And I'm very proud of him. I'm excited for him. Can't wait to see where he goes. And, you know, I know great things are in store for him.
Right, so what about Josh Jacobs? He says he's learned so much from you, too. When you come back to campus and, like, you're like a big brother to him, when you look at Josh as a running back, what do you see and how good can he be?
Very good. I would say he's a complete package. He can do it all. Run very hard. He's physical. Gets his nose in there, pass block, pass catching, every tool, you know, he checks every box, you know, at a running back needs, you know, going to the draft that the team is looking for. So I expect him to get picked tonight and have a great impact on which team he goes to. So I'm excited for him as well.
All right, so one last thing before I ask you about the FedEx Air and Ground program, which I'm going to get to. Speaking of the weight room, you're a monster in the weight room, and you recently posted a video with the legend Scott Cochran, the head strength and conditioning coach. What was it like to work out with him back in the day and having him get up in your grill, yell at you, and get you fired up?
Man, it was always fun with Coach Cochran, man. Always high energy, you know, always working hard, you know. So, you know, he definitely, you know, helped a lot of us get where we are today. You know, he's just like a head coach in himself. He spent a lot of time with us. Always bringing energy each and every day. So, you know, you had to bring it when you were working out with Coach Cochran. So it was definitely fun and a lot of great memories.
Right, so did you love the weight room from day one, or is that something you kind of had to grow to love?
I always did as a kid. I love the weight room. Love working out. I always had fun.
All right, so you're working with FedEx Air and Ground program, which supports the USO Pathfinder program. It helps service members and military spouses transition back to civilian life. What are you doing with them, and what do you like about that program?
I'm just excited to be a part of it, help them announce the $10,000 that they're donating to USO, you know, for the military, and giving them an opportunity to transition to civilian life and supporting the USO Pathfinder program. You know, I think that's very cool, a very great thing that FedEx is doing. You know, I'm just happy to be a part of it on behalf of the 2019 draftees, who will be Air and Ground Players of the Week. You know, just so cool. And me be a part of it. I bet they're giving back to the military and having this special moment, having me here. I'm just excited to be a part of it.
Good for you. It's also a really good program, the FedEx Air and Ground program. Always happy to work with those folks. Always happy to talk to those who represent them, including Derrick Henry. Derrick, good to run you down. Really nice to have you on the program. Great to talk to you.
And thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right, Dan, let's go to Barry in Des Moines. Good to have you, Barry. What's up?
Hey, Rome. It's actually not Barry. My friends call me the Barracuda.
That's not a good call. No. You don't like that call.
I don't like that call.
You got deep talk. You got deep. My man, Big John. What's up, John?
What's up, Romy? Y'all got it. Best show on earth. I was just going to let everybody know that I'm the original Frosty Sasquatch. I remember that day, Rome. I called in once. Our homeboy, he said, no, that ain't good enough. So I hung up, and I said, I'm going to go all the way off the wall. And I came back, and I thought about the Frosty Sasquatch. Thumpity thump thump thumpity thump thump thumpity thump thump thumpity thump thump. Frosty the Sasquatch had a hairy fluffy bone.
That's not a good call. No. You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
John, if I reset self-gloss day, but I did not play that phone call. You have to imagine that if you're going to sing about that, you're not going to get through your call either. Casey in Pensacola. Casey, what's up?
Hey, what's up, Romy Rome?
What's up, man?
Hey, man, is it any wonder that James Kelly's wife is having a C-section is my first point. You've seen that cracker's forehead. But this call goes to Rick and Buffalo, Parody Larry, Mike and Indy. They all like their subs like Jared likes his Subway, like he likes his women.
That's not a good call. No. You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Is it any wonder the flight deck's wife is having a C-section? You've seen that cracker's forehead.
Good night now.